Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. Welcome to this extra edition of SITREP. It's a sobering fact that more than 100 years after the First World War, to this day, more than 500,000 soldiers are still missing, a third of whom are thought to be buried as unknown. 2 years after the end of the Great War, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was established at Westminster Abbey and has served as a focal point for the public's grief ever since. As Remembrance Sunday approaches, a new book and theatre tour explore the history of the tomb and the painstaking efforts of finding, identifying and reburying the fallen. It's written by former tornado navigator and best-selling author John Nicol, who joins us for this special edition, along with a veteran who served in the Army for 30 years, Colonel Lindsay McDuff, who was involved in more than 200 repatriations from Iraq and Afghanistan.
In the aftermath of the First World War, with just over a million dead on the battlefields, and, as you say, just over 500,000 missing. So that's missing, never found, so lost to the mud, blown to smithereens in artillery barrages, or missing, buried unknown. And many of the listeners will have been to the great battlefields and the great war grave cemeteries, that famous quote, a soldier of the Great War, known unto God. There was a huge sense of loss in the country in 1918 and the couple of years, a massive sense of loss, a massive sense of grief. What we would probably refer to now as no closure. If you imagine, if you were, this is not the days of mobile phones and signals and emails. Mm. What many people would have had at some point during the war from 1914 is a simple telegram saying, regret to inform you that your husband, son, brother, Private X, Corporal Y, is dead, or is missing, presumed dead. And that would be it. They might get a few letters from friends saying, I saw him go down, but we never saw where, or something like that. But over 500,000 families had no information. So nothing. They didn't have anything. Can you imagine that for us now? And so one man, Reverend David Railton, who's a padre on the front line, an incredible man. He'd won the Military Cross at the Somme. A padre had won the Military Cross at the Somme for his bravery. A man who carried a Bible and not a rifle. He had buried hundreds, perhaps thousands, of the dead of his regiment, of his units. He'd striven through the whole of the war to try to tell the families, the loved ones, where I buried your loved one, where I buried your husband, where they are. This is how we identified him. And he, early 1916, he'd been really affected by one thing. He'd been at a battle near Armentières, and he'd gone back to his billet, which was in a bombed out building, a bombed out little house on the edge of the village. And somebody had buried one of the dead in the garden. And he said, I went into the garden, I can't remember the exact words, but he said, I went into the garden and there was buried, there was a grave. And it was marked with a simple cross, and it said, an unknown soldier. And interestingly for Lindsay, in actual fact, in brackets underneath, it said, of the Black Watch. Mm. And that was it. And Reverend Railton, David Railton, said, who is this man? What is his family thinking? What will they be saying in the valleys and the glens all those miles away? And he resolved to do something. In 1920, 2 years after the war, he did something. And he wrote to the Dean of Westminster Abbey, and he said, this is my plan. We'll bring back one unknown soldier. It became unknown warrior to represent the Navy and the Air Force. One unknown comrade to represent all of the missing, to try to quench the flow of guilt, the flow of sadness. And he said that in October, that plan was put into operation in October 1920, just 3 weeks before what we now know as Remembrance Sunday, or Armistice Day, the 11th, the second Armistice Day. And it all happened in an incredibly short space of time. And that story is an astonishing story.
And you write about how that warrior was chosen. How did it happen exactly?
Well, so there are a number of different accounts, but the man who was at the centre of it was Brigadier General Louis Wyatt, who was at the headquarters in St. Paul. So he was in charge, his director of graves registration. They were recovering the dead from the battlefield. And you've got to remember, Kate, that they were still tens of thousands. So I've just dug out some figures. In the aftermath of the war, they were recovering tens of thousands of the dead that were scattered, either not buried or buried in shell holes or something like that. Even after the war, 1921 to 1928, they found another 28,000 bodies. 28,000 that had never been registered. But Louis White was in charge of this process. And what he did was he sent out four teams to the four great battlefields, Ine, Ypres, Arras, and the Somme. And they were directed to disinter. So they'd been previously interring, burying the dead. They were directed to find a body that had no identification on it, that was marked as unknown, bring four unknowns back to my headquarters, which they did. Put the four unknowns on stretchers in the little chapel at St. Paul. And at midnight on the 9th, General Wyatt went into the chapel, and he says in his little writings, he said, "I selected one, we placed it in the coffin and screwed down the lid." Now, some people say he was blindfolded and did it. Nobody knows. Nobody knows how it happened. He says, "I selected one." So he selected one from four, from over 500,000. And that body then was treated with great reverence, and that became the unknown warrior, transported to Boulogne at the head of an astonishing parade of tens of thousands of troops, of French troops, children, to HMS Verdun at Boulogne Harbour, taken over the channel with great ceremony, transported through the dark of the night on the 10th to Victoria Station, where it laid guarded by the Grenadier Guards until November the 11th, which was Armistice Day, the day the new cenotaph that we know now was being unveiled, and the unknown warrior's burial became part of that ceremony. So it was an astonishing feat of logistic organisation and ceremony and pomp.
Yeah, it was quite, and the rest is history, as they say. Let's bring in Lindsay McDuff now. Lindsay, you served 30 years in the army, and you also served in the Black Watch, as John mentioned there. You're now a colleague at BFBS. I said earlier you've been involved in more than 200 repatriations. That was between 2008 and 2010. Can you tell me a bit more about the value and the pressure of that role?
From the team I was part of was really crucial in making sure that from the point of death or injury, those soldiers were looked after, and that they were ultimately, if they had died, they were repatriated. And back to John's point about having closure, I remember the awfulness, but also the compassionate way in which the repatriation ceremonies were done, where the families of the fallen were gathered together and able to welcome back their lost one, something that many, as you've heard, weren't able to have, and then to hand them on to the family for their burial or cremation further on was a huge honour. And as someone, as a soldier who'd spent most of my first half of my service on deployment, I had no understanding or comprehension about the amazing work that's done to deliver this and support it, particularly with the Joint Compassionate and Casualty Cell, who do a spectacular job, not just in looking after those that have recently fallen, but also those that have fallen some many years ago.
And John, before the Unknown Warrior was proposed, and even after that, bereaved families went to extraordinary lengths to find out what happened to their loved ones. During the Great War, there were some very specific challenges, though, weren't there, due to the intensity and the nature of the fighting that made identifying the body so difficult?
Yeah, and it was something. So when I started doing this book, part of it came about because of a BFBS Stroke Forces TV documentary during lockdown, where there was a document. It was part of the Mountbatten Festival of Music, and there was a 10-minute segment in that about the Unknown Warrior. Now, I knew very little about it. I'd been thinking about doing something, but that documentary for me really kind of helped me understand what had happened. And one of the things for me in my journey was of discovery to try to find out. Was to find out why so many were missing. How did so many men become nothing? So first of all, clearly one of the main ways was that they were in a barrage. They could be simply disintegrated. And I've got accounts from people who witnessed that, and there's one that says, our officer was killed and all we recovered was a bloodied foot in a boot to put in a sandbag. And that's all that they had to bury. So the other way was they could be lost in the mud. We'll all remember the horrible images from Passchendaele, the Somme, where the mud is 2-3 feet thick. If you went down in the mud and you were dead, there's a damn good chance that you were never, ever, ever recovered. But there was other ways as well, and I was astonished by this case. So, first of all, so many field burials were carried out at the edge of the battlefield, almost during the fighting. So a quick service, bury somebody in a shell scrape, cover them over, put a rifle upturned or put a little note, somebody keeping records. That person, and there's two accounts of that person moving, who kept the records, moving away from the grave, another shell landing, and the person with the records being killed and destroyed with the records. So the grave was lost, the person keeping the records was lost, or everything was lost. The other way was that sometimes people simply couldn't be identified. It's not like today, where Lindsay was there with his repatriations. Somebody dies and his mates are with them and they know who it is. And it's almost immediate. Back then, you could have thousands of people in one area, hundreds dying in one day with no means of identification if they didn't have identification on them or the identification was lost. A terrible way was that they were buried, the graves were marked, the records were kept, and then over the next 3 or 4 years, as the battles wove back and forwards, the graves would be blasted apart and the dead would be blasted out of the graves.
Oh.
It's beyond comprehension, Kate.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
The ways a man could become lost were astonishing. And so, you know, I've tried to bring that to life in the book and, of course, on stage, where I'll have people helping me understand. And, you know, Lindsay was talking there about repatriations. At one of the shows, one of the people that I'm fairly sure Lindsay must have repatriated, Corporal Lee Scott, his widow will be at the show to talk about how important, and Lindsay said it there, how important it is to have the information, to have a body, to have a grave, to have somewhere to mark, to recognise.
Yeah.
That really puts it into perspective, one person as opposed to 500,000.
Yeah, and Lindsay, you were involved, weren't you, in repatriating Corporal Lee Scott? I'm just wondering, I mean, John said there, it's not like it is today carrying out those repatriations. What kind of unique challenges did you face, though, when you were repatriating the fallen between 2008 and 2010?
Before I do that, just to John's point, I'm not from a military family, but my father's uncle was a private soldier in the First World War, was killed in Italy in 2016, and I were fortunate enough to be the defense attaché in Italy in 2016, and I was able to go on the centenary of his death to his grave and remember him. And with me, I had the letter from his troop commander, which talked about what happened. So we were one of the fortunate ones that had that knowledge. The biggest challenge that I think we faced in the repatriation process, apart from all the technical challenges and logistical implications, was the race against time to inform the family before the media got hold of it. And I remember when I was doing OC rear op, so commanding the rear operations of the battalion when it was deployed in Iraq in 2004, the commanding officer had phoned me and said, we've had an incident and the name of the person has been injured. Could I go and talk to his wife and let her know what the injuries are? I went around to her house. We had a cup of tea. Just as we sat down to drink the tea, her phone went buzzing. And it was another wife who thought she was doing the right thing, giving her the wrong information about the extent of his injuries. And so that race against time is ever present and was the most challenging thing we faced.
And John, go on, you were going to say something.
No, Kate, sorry, go ahead.
It's interesting, though, you know, time makes me think of a detail in your book, John, which was that the efforts that were made by some of the relatives, the bereaved relatives, to find their loved sons, to find out what happened to them. And one in particular, Robert Hamilton, a Canadian soldier, his father, you know, he ran out of time to find out what happened. Can you just tell me a little bit about his story?
I mean, it's astonishing. And just, again, the experiences of one person helps to fill in the blanks about all of the missing and the experiences of all of those families. So Robert Hamilton's son was killed towards the end of the war. And although he was taken back to a first aid station, at some point his body was lost. And nobody knows how. He was in a first aid station. He was reported in a first aid station. And at some point his body was lost and he became one of the unknown, or buried as an unknown. Nobody knows. Robert, his father refused to accept this, and for 10 years after the war, mounted the most astonishing series of investigations. And you've got to remember, this is 1918, 1920, 21. There's no internet. This is letters going across the sea from Canada, which could take 3 or 4 weeks to be delivered to headquarters. And he went, he got all of the battalion records, and he said, right, I think my son could be buried in this grave. And so he had the graves registration, said, OK, we'll see if we can find out. And they disinterred the body. And they said, no, it's not. And the way that he was going to try and identify, and this is quite brutal, his son had been hit in the head by shrapnel and lost part of his head. And so for him, if he could find a decomposing body, I won't say it any more than that, Kate, with a severe head wound, that could be his son. But he didn't just finish it at one. He mounted another 55 disinterments from 1918 to 1926, when he died and the idea died with him. 55 bodies were dug out of the ground. Some of them had been dead for 10 years, 11 years. And he wanted to know if one of them was his son. And I think that tells you all. And there's another story where a woman mounted a secret mission to secretly dig up the remains of him. She knew her son was buried there. She mounted a mission to dig him up and have him returned. I mean, that's astonishing. There was a courier on another secret mission found at Antwerp with a suitcase with the remains of a body in it that he was taking back to England. I mean, it sounds almost farcical, but it gives you a sense of the depth of loss and the depth of grief.
And Lindsay, I mean, the work never stops, does it? Because you are about to attend the reburial of two British soldiers who fought in the Battle of Loos in the First World War. Some 30,000 Scots took part in that battle with thousands of fatalities. I mean, that must really resonate with you. Can you tell us a bit more about this reburial?
Well, it's quite remarkable that they have identified which regiment the individual belongs to. And what's really touching is that soldiers from my regiment will be carrying his coffin and reburying him. I've done a number of those, and even when you're not connected to the person, it is an enormously emotional and privileged thing to be able to do, to witness that, and also to pay our respects to those that have fallen. And what I think John is doing brilliantly is telling the story. And in John McCrae's fab poem, which is called In Flanders Fields, there's a great line which is about from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. And I think what John is doing brilliantly is holding the torch high so that people's stories are being told, so that people understand just the lengths and extent to which people work hard to pay the appropriate respects for those people that have paid the ultimate sacrifice.
And there will be two burials, is that right? Will there just be one at Loos then?
There are two burials. One is has been identified as someone serving in the Black Watch, and the second one they've identified that he served in a Scottish regiment. They don't know quite which regiment it was.
Okay. Sorry, John.
That search goes on. You know, so I used two examples and three examples in the book of in recent times. The joint casualty reporting cell, is that right, Lindsay? What we refer to as the war detectives. What's the correct name, Lindsay?
The Joint Compassionate and Casualty Centre.
Yeah, the Joint Compassionate. Sorry, I should know that. It's written in the book. You know, the work that they do to identify the dead, and I've got a couple of examples that I use in the show and the book. It is astonishing. And on one hand, you have people saying, why do we bother? What's the point, 104 years on, of spending time and money and effort? But then when you read the accounts of the relatives of the lost, albeit three generations on, and their gratitude that says, somebody cared about my great uncle. That's astonishing.
Lindsay.
John, just to come back, when I was also in Rome, in Italy, I went to a reburial of a soldier in Catania in Sicily. Mm-hmm. And the JCCC, the Joint Casualty and Compassionate Centre, had done this amazing forensic mm-hmm. work to identify his relatives. And they came to the reburial. Mm-hmm. And it was, amazingly emotional experience, not just for them, but for all of us who were able to witness it.
But they had something, Lindsay, we have something today that, of course, that they didn't have then, DNA. And of course, that there's a couple of examples of people who have come from all over the world to see somebody in reality they didn't know and had never really heard of, great Uncle George, great, great Uncle Stan. But DNA now means that somebody can say, my God, my family was part of the nation's history. That makes me emotional just saying it. That's really important.
And John, I mentioned earlier, you've got this, you've got your book coming out on this, you've got the theatre tour as well. What are you offering with that exactly?
Well, so the book is obviously, the story is my journey of discovery. So I didn't know anything about the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior, and I set out to discover it. So just the simple fact that, when I was in Westminster Abbey, I'd seen it, but I didn't know really that there was a body there. I hadn't read it properly. And then when you read it, then I went back to the battlefields, and then I went back to the headquarters of the Graves Registration Unit, and then I followed the journey, and I spoke to people who would help me understand. So the grand ceremony on Armistice Day, how do you organise that? Who better to speak to about the grand ceremonial occasions than the Garrison Sergeant Major, Mr. Stokes, who's an old friend, who I went to sit with him in his office. Well, I stood and he sat, and listened, and he talked me through organising the late Queen's funeral and the King's coronation. And when you can hear people talking about that, you begin to understand what it must have been like 104 years ago. And so that journey I translate onto stage with staging, with lights. We've got, instead of me just writing letters, we've got actors to reread the letters of the fallen, reread the letters of the loved ones, to recreate the battles and recreate the soundscapes of bringing that body home. What was it like to be there to see it?
And just one question, final question to both of you. Where will you be on Remembrance Sunday? John, you want to go first?
Oh, I'll be where I always am, Kate. I'll be at the Cenotaph. I march with what is now a diminishing band of Royal Air Force ex-prisoners of war. When I first, this tells you all you need to know. When I first started going to Cenotaph 25 years ago, there were possibly 200 or 300 of us marching, obviously mostly World War II veterans. Now there are 4 or 5, and we're all Gulf War veterans. All of our World War II veterans are dead. The two survivors can't make it anymore. So I'll be at the Cenotaph.
Lindsay?
I'll enjoy not wearing uniform, walking, marching with the local Royal British Legion branch in our village to the memorial.
Brilliant. Thank you to both of you. John's book, The Unknown Warrior, is out now. And Lindsay McDuff, we look forward to your reports from Lewes on all BFBS platforms.
News, discussions and analysis. This is SITREP.